crazy it seems to have a dream to open and run a bakery. But they took a chance, took the sweets to the street. Now they all have places where I'd love to eat.
Hello there, bakeroos and bakerettes. Welcome to the Rise Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Dick, and this is the show about bakers and bakeries and bakery owners and all the folks that work so hard, often through the night, to make the good stuff and serve it to the people in their communities. How's it going today? Is November treating you well? I sure hope so. Where I am, fall is here. It's getting gray and the sun is getting up late and going down early, but that's all right. It's lovely. We went outside to the Remembrance Day ceremony on Remembrance Day on Monday. And it was the first one we ever went to in Victoria, and it was neat because it's so mild here. The whole service is done outdoors, and so there were thousands of people out around the cenotaph in front of the legislature, and the lieutenant governor was there, and all kinds of officials and stuff. And what I'm used to is going to the cenotaph in Regina and literally freezing, and they kind of rush through the ceremony because it's minus 15 Celsius and. The smart people have all gone indoors to the big arena for a big ceremony, but us, pure-blooded folks go out in the cold and stand around the cenotaph and go to the ceremony there. But it was good. It was a nice service. And it's neat now because I've been reading a lot more about veterans, military veterans that are being created all the time. People are serving in the military all the time and returning all the time. But we have this idea in our heads of military veterans being, really old folks, like from World War II and the Korean conflicts and stuff. And people are serving and getting involved in messy situations and dealing with conflict and that all the time. And, they could be in their 30s and be retired and be a veteran. And we don't necessarily think of them the same way. So that's what I thought about during the ceremony this year was, the people that sign up voluntarily and join the military and serve and do peacekeeping and that kind of thing in times when they don't make the news all that much. But they appear to be in no less danger in a lot of situations. So I don't know. That's what I was thinking about. Today on the show, it's a big day today because Daniel Leader is on the show. That Daniel Leader, the author of three books. He's got a brand new book out now. The owner and founder of Bread Alone Bakery in New York State and one of my heroes. Oh boy, was I ever excited to talk to him. So that's coming up in a little bit and I'll give you a proper lead into that soon. But I just wanted to share a goofy story about our new life here in Victoria, trying to get used to living in an apartment, trying to get used to living in a city that doesn't snow and doesn't freeze that much. It snows a little bit in the winter, I'm told, but I haven't experienced it yet. And I keep on phoning home and it's, minus 20 when I talk to my dad and he's freezing and, He walks out to feed the cats twice a day out on the little farm where he lives, and that's it. And otherwise, he's inside because it's just bloody freezing out. And I don't miss it. I feel bad about that, but I don't miss it at all. I miss the people, but I certainly don't miss the weather. But part of living in this nice, mild city and living downtown is Cindy and I get to do our traditional Saturday date night on foot. Ever since we had the bakery, and then especially when I had the backyard bakery, we'd both be working all week, and I'd be doing my thing, and Cindy'd be off working at Magpie's Kitchen and stuff, and we'd see each other. But you're busy, and you're doing a lot of work. But we always had this thing that Saturday, after the backyard bakery was done, and after Cindy was home from work, we would always go out for our burger night, date night, and. The problem is that in Regina, there weren't very many good burger places. So we would go to different places, but then quite often we'd end up going to like Carl's, which was sort of like the best fast food burger in the city, which is, it was pretty good, but it, you know, kind of sad that that's the best that you can do. And now that we're in Victoria, we're keeping up this tradition. Even though our work schedules have changed, Saturday night is still date night and we go out for supper. Except there's a problem, because there are so many restaurants here that we want to try and we want to go to, and not just for burgers, but there's pubs and there's, you know, Asian places and Indian places and just every type of food you can imagine. And they have a great breakfast scene here. So there's lots of brunches if we wanted to shift gears and go out at 2 p.m. instead of in the evening. And everything's within walking distance. So it's like, you know, 3 blocks away from, oh, there's probably 100 restaurants within 6 blocks of where we live. Like, I'm not kidding you. It's pretty wild that way. Except we have our favorite burger place already. And it's just over on Cook Street. It's called Big Wheel Burgers. And it's just awesome. You know, they've got a few tables and you have to, you know, walk up to the counter to order. So it's sort of like a fast food place, except they're making everything to order. And I don't know what they do with these burgers, but they are the best burgers I've ever had. And like just for taste, like just for pure taste. And so we have 100 restaurants within 6 blocks of us. That's the number I'm picking. And I think we've been to Big Wheel 5 times in 7 weeks. It's that bad, but I just love them. And we go to another place, like we'll look up, you know, the best of Victoria and say, oh, these guys won best burger. And we'll go and we'll say, yeah, that's really, really good. But I miss whatever they're putting in the burgers at Big Wheel. So I don't know what it is. Maybe it's romance. Maybe it's that it's kind of sort of a rough and rugged little place with, you know, plastic chairs and tables that aren't quite level and that kind of thing. And it's really noisy because they have, you know, they always seem to have like the prog rock channel on whenever we're there. So it's like, you know, 14-minute long songs with 7-minute guitar solos and lots of screaming and stuff. And it's noisy and they're all shouting in the back and calling out orders and stuff. But I absolutely love it. We get our 2 little seats along the window and it's wonderful. It's just the absolute best. But I think we're going to have a second date night, maybe midweek now, so we can try out these other restaurants because they sure look great. But when you know what you like, you keep on going to the same place. And hopefully that's what you're doing with your bakeries, I guess. I'm sure that you have customers that it's like, oh, this is my happy place when I come into the bakery and I get my signature loaf, whatever that happens to be, or my favorite pastry. And I know we had it at our bakeries and I know you've got it too. And so hopefully this week, maybe there's a time that you might just want to make a little eye contact with that customer that's got that look of just bliss on their face because they've walked into your place and it happens to be their best place in the world, sort of their equivalent of Big Wheel Burgers. So something to think about. Oh, and a Bakers for Bakers update. I'm embarrassed about this, but it's true. We launched Bakers for Bakers last week. That's Bakers for Bakers, the number 4bakers.org. And people are signing up and I'm super excited and really nervous and looking forward to welcoming them into the community, except my sign-up process broke and I didn't know it was broken. And then people started signing up and I realized it was broken and I'm still working on fixing it. I have a plan of attack now. I just have to get it done today, hopefully over today and tomorrow. It's going to be quite a bit of work. It turns out that I wasn't thinking of how the flow worked in the same way that this plugin that I'm using is designed to work. But I found that out last weekend, and I have a plan of attack. So I'm sorry. Be patient. We're going to get this thing going real quick, and I'll let you know on next week's show how we're doing. But for now, if you want to go, there's a place to join and a little application form, and I keep all of those, and I will reach out to you directly when I get everything set up so you can actually sign into the site. It's bakersforbakers.org. That's with the number 4, bakers, number 4, bakers.org. Check it out. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're going to learn a lot. But now, the big show, Daniel Leader, owner of Bread Alone, founder of Bread Alone, writer, author of three amazing books. I have to say, when I was dreaming about opening my bakery, and right around the time that I opened it, you know, I bought Bread Alone, I bought a second book, Local Breads, and I just devoured them. Not for the recipes as much as, you know, they were useful. Now, back then, all the recipes were still in cups and spoons and that kind of thing, and they didn't really convert to weights or baker's percentages much, which is interesting. We actually talk about that a bit in our talk. But just this world of visiting other bakeries and meeting other bakers and sharing ideas and bringing those ideas back to your place and making your version of them was super inspiring to me. And so I devoured both books. And so he's got a new book out now. And one of the folks that's helping, well, his publisher reached out to me and said, would you like to talk to Daniel Leader and have him on your podcast? And I'm like, are you kidding me? Of course I would. Like, he's a person right from the first day of thinking about this podcast was one of the people that I wanted to have on the show. And I was just waiting for the right time, which means getting up the nerve to ask him to come on. And then they reached out to me. And so I was thrilled. And so we had a really great chat. But instead of me talking about the chat, why don't I share it with you? That's what the show is all about. So here it is, me talking with Daniel Leader, founder of Bread Alone Bakery in New York State, and awesome author. Here we go.
I saw that you interviewed Helene Godin.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it's so funny because, I do a bit of work with her husband, Seth, these days, which is kind of cool. And, so all of my friends in that world, that's the one episode that they were the most pumped about. It's like, oh, you actually got to talk to Seth's wife. Right. But, it was cool. It was neat because,
I actually helped her open up her very first shop.
Did you really? That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, the long story short, Seth is from Buffalo. I'm from Buffalo.
Okay.
And Seth went to summer camp with my sisters.
Oh, wow. Okay. So cool. Yeah. Well, and I know he's a big summer camp guy. That's his thing. So, oh, that's awesome. Really neat to know. So I guess the Bread Alone story for me was something that really captured my imagination when I first got into baking. Like I think I found your first book kind of early and, reading about that. And I guess one of the questions I've got is like you started in the early 80s and it seems to me that it was quite a different time then for bread and for baking. And, or am I right there? Cause it's,
oh yeah.
You'd have been quite the pioneer in doing what you did then.
Well, you know, there were three bakeries that I knew about that opened before we did that were kind of in this style.
Right. Okay.
There was this bakery called Baldwin Hill, mm-hmm. which was one of the first, it came out of it came out of the macrobiotic community. Okay.
They were making
sourdough whole wheat bread that they stone ground their own flour in Phillipston, Mass. It was run by a doctor named High Werner. And then there's this bakery that still exists now called Old Bread in Shelburne, Vermont.
Okay.
Which was the original kind of like Vermont sourdough bakery grinding their own flour again. And then there was Jules Rabin and his wife Helen that had a little like backyard bakery in near Montpelier, Vermont.
Okay.
And then in New York City, there was the old school, D&G bakery. I often say to people, if you saw that movie Moonstruck with Nicolas Cage,
right?
He's a baker in this bakery in Brooklyn. But at that moment, there were like a couple little offshoot beginning organic hippie bakeries. And then there was the Italian bakeries that you would find in a lot of cities around the country. And then it turns out coincidentally that Acme Bread and Bread Alone opened the same month, the same year.
Oh, really? How cool.
Yeah.
So what got you into that this was something that you wanted to do?
No. I went to culinary school.
Oh, okay.
And I used to bake bread in college from the Tassajara bread book. Okay. So I had this like little bread thing, but it didn't make any sense. You know, like what was his name? Edward Espe, the guy, he was a Zen monk in San Francisco, and he wrote this very famous bread book. You can still buy it, Tassajara bread book.
That's right. Yeah.
And then I went to cooking school, and I was working in French restaurants first of all, I was the only American in the kitchen. Okay. So I was thrown into like French culture in New York. So my working world was in French. My home world was in English. And I had to learn French because I didn't really speak well at the time. And the restaurants at that time, all the French restaurants closed the month of August.
Okay.
I mean, if you can imagine in today's world, French restaurants in New York City, okay, we're going to close for a month, you know? I think there's only one that still does it. And so my colleagues were from all over France. And I would get these invitations, come visit us. And so I stumbled into some bakeries on my own, but I stumbled into a lot of bakeries being taken in by my colleagues.
Wow.
And I just kind of became, you know, infatuated with like the simplicity and the beauty and the humbleness of baking bread. And I was working at fancy French restaurants.
Right, you know, right.
With big white hats and starched jackets. And so the world of t-shirts and flour and bread seemed a lot more appealing to me.
Sure, yeah.
And then I started moonlighting at D&G Bakery on Mulberry Street, which was one of the original coal-fired bakeries in New York.
Okay.
And then I had bought this little cottage up here outside of Woodstock, and there was a building that came for sale. Like it had been a tractor garage or something. And I was able to buy it for, I think, $22,000, no money down. And the owner held the mortgage.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And we built a little brick oven in it. And that's how Bread Alone started. I mean, it was really on a song and a prayer.
Wow. Wow. And it's just grown and grown and grown. Like you're.
Yeah. The bakery, you know, we've had years where we've grown 20%.
Yeah.
But like most years, we're growing 10%, 8%, 9%. But it's been this very long, slow, you know, like, and, you know, part of the reason it's been long and slow is that I never wanted to bring in partners or investors or, you know, so we've grown on our own steam.
Nice.
So the beauty of Bread Alone is we don't have to answer to anybody.
Yeah.
But they're customers.
That's right. Yep.
We have a mortgage. We built a new bakery a few years ago, but you know, we can pretty much choose our own destiny.
Yeah.
But the bread world has changed completely since. I mean, people didn't even know what baguettes were. People didn't know what a ciabatta was, or
sure,
sourdough, or you know what I mean. Yeah. So we've rode this wave of interest in bread. And now there's, you know, loads of little bakers that remind me of Bread Alone.
Right.
When I started.
Sure. You
know? Except now everybody's supposed to grind their own flour, you know. You know, I joke, I was talking to the guy from O Bread, you know, the owner of O Bread. He had milled his own flour for years. And I said, Chuck, can you believe this? That like to be a good baker now, you have to grind your own flour, you know,
yeah,
in the bakery. And he said, you know, and I agreed with him. I said, like, isn't this work hard enough? Like,
yeah, that's right.
Like, yeah. do we have to be millers too?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's been really interesting to see what's happened. And I say this out of observation and experience, not out of judgment, what I'm about to say. So we're 37 years.
Wow.
Okay. I think this is what I will call the third wave.
Okay.
Okay. There was a wave after Bread Alone and Acme. There was a wave like people like Tomcat, Nancy Silverton.
Right.
Okay. They were kind of the first wave. And then there was a second wave like around 2000. And let's call this, if we're in the teens now, let's call this the third wave.
Sure.
The third wave is getting much more artisan and much more sourdough and much more whole grain and much more like rugged, earthy breads.
Right.
And, you know, in the other generations. But what I've seen is that there's about a 10-year cycle.
Okay.
And then people burn out. They sell out. They burn out. They can't do it anymore. They realize they're not making enough money. They can't find help. And, you know, I look at this new crop of, let's call them farmers, markets, little wholesale-based bakeries.
Right, yes.
Okay. You have them all over Canada now.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. So they're making, you know, 200 breads a day, or they got a little wood-fired oven, or they got a little this, and they got a little mill. And it's like, let's call them, you know, extreme artisans.
Sure, right.
Like, okay, where will they be in 10 years?
Yeah. Okay. That's the question. And I think there's a chasm or a bit of a gulf there to try and get to that, to the next level,
Then you face all of the distribution problems, you face shelf life problems, you face packaging problems, you face labeling problems. I mean, you go to a farmer's market, you can say organic, holy flour, blah, blah, blah. And then you face food safety problems because bakeries are part of the Food Service Modernization Act. So bakeries have to be all food safety compliant.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm curious to see if there will be a new way that I don't see.
Right.
Like I saw recently there was a baker who did a subscription, like almost like a CSA.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, so he was guaranteeing sales. And the other thing about it is, I don't know what it's like in Canada, but I have a little house up in Maine, and the bakers up there are selling their let's call them the ultra artisan breads.
Yeah.
For $8.50 a loaf.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now, we would be out of business, bread alone, if we sold our bread for, if the customers had to pay $8.50 a loaf.
Sure.
For bread. Either I'd be really rich, or I'd right. be out of business.
Yeah, one way or the other.
One way or the other. But, you know, I'm really curious to see, you know, this juncture of local grains, bakers grinding their own flour, the micro bakery concept.
Yep, yep.
I'm really curious to see how this is all going to evolve, okay?
Right, right.
So I'll use a line that I've used in many of the interviews that I've been doing since the book came out. So if this is the beginning of the beginning, okay, of a real change, I think about 1983 when Whole Foods opened.
Right.
And I think, well, if someone would have asked me in 1983, what will happen to Whole Foods Market? It was a little 200 meter store in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I've seen pictures of it.
Okay. Yeah.
It was just a little health food store, and it's now leading the charge. I mean, Amazon bought them. It's leading the charge of, you know, many food trends.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, is this the beginning of the beginning? This local grain, super artisan bread. Is this going to grow like the small breweries? Is it going to be, you know, 10 years ago, nobody knew what kombucha was.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-billion dollar business.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, I just kind of asked the question, is this the beginning of another phase that will just kind of burn itself out because it's so hard?
Yeah.
Okay. And, or is this the beginning of something that will have legs? Okay.
Right. Right.
And certainly Instagram is helping.
Yeah. Well, it really is. Like, my goodness, just with folks that are following me and then I follow back because of the podcast, my bread feed's insane. Like, or my Instagram feed, it's like, you know, about every 30th picture is from, you know, a friend of mine, and here's a picture of their dog or something. The rest of it is bread and baking and watching.
No, and the breads are are good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I would compare these breads against any great European artisan baker.
Sure, sure. Okay.
The only thing I don't like about what Instagram has done, and do you know Nikki Giusto from yes. Central Millie?
Yeah.
So Nikki and I were talking recently. It seems that the definition of good bread, okay, if you're going to go to Instagram and yeah. say, how do you define good bread? You're going to say, well, it's kind of a roundish oval loaf. It's got one big cut in the middle. The cut splits wide open.
Yep.
The crust is very dark. And the cell structure is just what they call it in French. They call it, I love the name in French, they call it alvéolage exotique. Okay. So this wild,
yes.
you know, like wild fermentation structure.
Right.
Okay. And everybody, like all the Instagram feeds, oh my God, my cells were so big. How did you get that? Yeah. How much local stone ground flour did you use? What was your sourdough percentage? And everybody's talking in baker's percent now. It's like nobody knew what baker's percent was 10 years
That's ago. Right. Yeah.
Now everybody's talking in baker's percent. Everyone's talking about how long the long cold fermentation is and how many folds and, you know, how big the structure is. And the reality is that this big exotic fermentation, this alvéolage exotique, it's one kind of bread.
Yeah.
I would not want to say it's the definition of good bread.
Yeah.
Definition of one kind of good bread. Totally, but you have totally. Bakers all over the world. And I think it was influenced by Chad.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was very influenced by the first Jim Leahy book. Unkneaded bread that was
right.
very wild. Okay. And it seemed to have really caught on. But I think it should be very clear this is just a style of baking.
Right on. Yeah. No, I totally. I talk about that on the show a lot even in the intros is that, you know, there's all kinds of good stuff out there and you need to, I try and love it all, you know, exactly. Right. I was at a bakery, you know, a real old school, you know, looked like a family run bakery with all the daughters in the front a couple of weeks ago, you know, selling on a Sunday. And yeah, it's like, it's an old school bakery. A lot of white flour in that case, but it's, you know, apple turnovers and they've got the crullers and they've got muffins and cookies and a couple loaves of bread and the place is packed and everybody's happy. So it's like, there's nothing wrong with that too, you know?
That's absolutely. And, you know, what I tried to do, do you have a copy of the new book? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet. No, okay. I've
so just... you'll see, I worked with a stunning photographer. I mean, the response has been phenomenal, but we were very careful to not overemphasize the loose cell structure.
Right on. Yeah.
You're going to see a lot of photos that look like Dutch Van Gogh paintings of bread and, you know, because... You know, certainly in Germany, northern Germany, you don't see any of that.
Sure.
Southern Italy, you don't see any of it. In France, if you look at Poilin, you can see bubbles of fermentation, but they're basically very dense breads.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
It you know, there's no big nooks and crannies in a loaf of Poilin.
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah. Or even the fella... Oh, and I can never pronounce the name of the bakery, but he's been on all the shows and he's up in Paris in the, a little further out and he bakes his stuff really, really dark. Like it's.
What's the first name?
I'm sorry. I don't recall, but I was there and bought some bread and it was awesome. But the crumb structure is, different with every loaf that he's making, you know, it's. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's really, you know, I think it's important to not overplay that. And from a strictly practical point of view,
yeah,
as from a point of view of a baker, not trying to be the super artisan baker.
Right. Yeah.
Commercial customers don't want bread like that.
They want
sandwiches and they want to put butter and mayonnaise and mustard on it. And, you know, when you have bread like that, it's not you know, you, I guess you could have a ciabatta roll or a baguette you cut sideways.
Yeah.
But like you have a big loaf and you cut it slices, like my customers would lynch me. You know what I mean? Like
if I'm with you.
Like I would have screaming customers if all of our bread had big holes like that.
Yeah. No, same thing when I had my retail bakery, and then even I baked out of my backyard for a while after I closed my retail bakery. And because I think you would put me in the group of people that was doing it and then got really tired and got out, you know, and then I went smaller. I went to my backyard, but, I would have customers saying, okay, it's starting to get a little wild now, you know, it's like, oh, it's better now. It's not as wild as last week or something exactly. Like that. And it's like, yeah, I can relate for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So go ahead.
I just wanted to ask just back on the point about that sort of the 10-year cycle or the folks that are, there's a lot of people that I talk to that are trying to stay small for as long as possible because once you get into staffing, like when people can get their head around, okay, I'm a solo shop and I can set it up to be a solo shop. But a lot of the people that I talk with is like, once you start introducing staff into it and you start building it out just that little bit bigger, it becomes a completely different set of priority, set of focus almost, you know, where you're totally focused on the craft of baking when you were solo, and then you've accidentally sort of started a business here, and now you've got a business to,
you know, I mean,
to work
this
on.
This is a complicated question because if you stay at if you stay on that very small level, you are essentially married to your business. It's kind of like being a dairy farmer. It's like think about why do people leave dairy farming because you got to milk the cows twice a day.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You are making a commitment to that lifestyle. And I suppose if you can make 300 or 400 breads 3 times a week by yourself and get $9 a loaf, and you're getting $3,000-$4,000 a day, and you got a little electricity and a little water, and a wood oven or not wood oven. Yeah, I suppose you can make $100,000 a year
right.
or more doing it by yourself. Okay, but that means sweeping the floor. It means washing the baskets. I mean, it's a commitment.
Yeah. Okay?
So what's the balance between that, which is, let's just call that a craft baker.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. And then someone says, oh, well, you know, I want to go to the next level. Well, they have to become a manager. They have to know how to train people.
Yeah.
They have to find people. Even though bread seems to be popular right now, every baker I know says, I can't find any help.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So, it's a complicated question, and this speaks back to the 10-year cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You know, you make that commitment. I'm just going to have a helper. You know, I'm going to find a woofer or a college kid, or I'm going to find somebody to be here for 6 months or a year, and then find another one. And I'm going to do it by myself. And I'm going to sell the bread at the farmer's market. I'm going to bake the bread one day and sell it at the farmer's bread market the next day. It's hard, you know.
Sure.
It's really hard. You know, what we've done is we've grown big enough. We have health benefits. We have a retirement plan. We pay people good wages. We have a big operation now. I mean, it's by artisan bread standards. Even when I go to France, people say, wow, you know, you guys are not a small bakery anymore. But having said that, we have a scholarship at the CIA for people that are interested in bread. We're going to start one at Johnson & Wales. We're able to bring young people in and stay 6 months, and they can make $15, $16, $17 an hour. You know, we're not spending 2.5 minutes scoring each loaf of bread.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yep.
But we've been organic since day one. We have, you know, we have state-of-the-art sourdough system. You know, we're using stress-free dividers. I mean, you know, we've got you know, we work, I joke with people that we think somewhere between a French and Italian baker, but work a lot like German bakers in terms of the organization and the structure.
Gotcha.
But bread alone is a sustainable business.
And there you go. Yeah. Well, and then, and it just, it seemed, I'm assuming that you had, if not the vision for what it is today, right at the start, but at least that attitude of, okay, this is going to be bigger than me running a solo operation from the start. And that, that was,
I mean, maybe we were the one person bakery for a year or two.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I talked with Helene, that was the best part of the conversation for me, was just this attitude for her. There was no way, she knew that wasn't her skill set. She wasn't going to be the baker anyways. And so she, you know, I have an idea for the bakery, but I'm going to be finding.
This is curious. Helene came to visit our new bakery.
Okay.
Maybe 4 months after we moved in.
Yeah.
She saw the leap that we made, and, you know, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't an insignificant leap.
Sure.
Of the kind of equipment. Are you familiar with a company called Hoyft?
No,
Hoyft,
I don't believe
is probably the leading company in Germany, H-E-U-F-T.
Oh, okay.
H-E-U-F-T, Hoyft Thermal Oil Ovens. So we have a deck oven with 12 decks.
Right.
Oh. With a loading robot.
That sure.
Right in and out. But we still proof the bread in Benetons and in baskets. And we have a loading table. You pour the breads out and the Benetton, you score them. There's a loader that picks them up. We don't have somebody standing from the oven to see if the bread's done. There's a computer that controls that.
Right.
But, you know, we're able to bake 1,000 baguettes in 30 minutes.
Right. Right.
You know, so, you know, I could see how some super artisans might think, well, you know, they've compromised here, they compromised here. They don't divide by hand. You know, we reformulated our baguette recipe. We go directly from the stress-free divider into a baguette molder.
Okay.
We don't shape every baguette by hand, but we have the best baguette molder in the world.
That's right. Yeah. So you're finding the balance to make everything work.
Yeah, it's you know, these are not simple questions.
Sure.
These are, you know, I would say that there's a certain reality in baking life that we all hit.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think it's a good to have the discussion.
Yeah.
One of the concerns I have is, you know, and maybe it shouldn't be a concern, you know, the craft beer industry seems to have grown and survived with craft beers. What are they, 3 times more glass? Like if you went and just got, a Corona tap, and then you get your local tap beer, is it 3 times the price?
Oh, well, I don't know, but it's got to be at almost double for sure.
Yeah.
Up here,
My question is, you know, I it scares me when I see artisan bread at $8-$9 a loaf.
Yeah.
Because it becomes, I mean, in my mind, it becomes an elitist food. You know,
that's right. Yeah.
And so, you know, you can go get commercial bread for what, $2 a loaf, you know, 2 for $4. So if something like our bread tends to be around $5 a loaf in the supermarkets,
right?
But we used to be 4 and it went to 5 only because the supermarkets all up their margins.
You know, right. Yep.
We may have raised the price a nickel or a dime.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that $5 a loaf or $5.50 a loaf seems much more affordable than $9 a loaf or $8.
Oh, for sure.
$10.
For sure. Well, and that's, you know, that's sort of the arithmetic, right? Is that if you're going to run a business where you can provide a living wage for people and you can provide the benefits and stuff, and you've got a price at $5, let's say, or, you know, whatever your piece of that is, then the only thing you can change is volume, right? You know, like that's what it's going to be. And so how can you make the best product that you can
right
at the volumes that you need? in
the, right, right,
yeah,
exactly. You
know, and not everyone has the I don't know, the stomach for it, or just that, like, it's a mental shift for some people that they just won't go there, you know, like,
maybe that mental shift is after 10 years, they're going to say, you know, it's too much.
Yeah.
You know, sure. I'm going to do something else. I did this for a while and it was a good run, and you know what I mean?
Yep.
You know, but I think if we look at it as a component of the food supply.
Right.
Okay. And this is something I've been speaking a lot about. Okay. So we're baking these artisan breads at a moment when every food magazine, every food writer has something about gluten-free or no gluten, okay, at the same time. Like,
yeah.
Every doctor is talking about it. Every nutritionist is talking about it. Everybody's talking about this thing. Okay. And yet you've got this movement that is happening at the same moment.
Right.
And what I have been saying to people, and I have a chapter in the book that Okay. So I have a chapter in the book called Heritage Wheat, Ancient Grains and Wheat Sensitivity. Okay. And one of the things that I've been making a case for is that artisan breads are a different kind of food.
Okay.
So, okay, they're made from wheat or they're made from grains, but they are a different kind of food.
Right. Okay. Totally get it.
So if on one side you've got breads made from over-refined flour with vital wheat gluten, with inulin, ground from wheat that's been pesticides, herbicides, fungicides.
Yeah.
Okay. And then made into bread from bakeries that are using dough conditioners, preservative, fats, all the stuff you can imagine.
Yeah.
And all the things you don't want to imagine. And a yeast percentage of 5%.
Right.
Like having a commercial bakery with 5% yeast.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Is not unheard of.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like, you
yeah, go sure.
to a
yeah.
bakery. Okay. So people have the opportunity to react to the pesticides and herbicides. People have the possibility to react to the inulin and wheat gluten. People have the possibility to react to the over-refined flour. People have the possibility to react to all of the commercial yeast and the preservatives. Okay?
Oh, sure.
Okay. And yet when we talk about bread, everything's included.
That's right. Yes.
And I'm making the very strong case that artisan bread is a different kind of food.
Yeah.
First of all, most artisan bakers are using certified organic wheat and or transitional wheat.
Right.
Okay. Most of it is milled sensibly. Okay. Meaning it's not over milled.
Right.
And whether it's stone milled or whether it's roller milled.
Right.
You know, even companies like King Arthur now keep trying to increase the ash content and have more germ in there. And you know what I mean? I did a demo the other day with King Arthur flour, and I was like, wow, look at the color of this flour. It's not the same color that it was 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So you've got organic wheat, you've got stuff, bread that's made sensibly, okay, milled sensibly. You don't have any additives, preservatives of any kind. Okay. The sourdough is a probiotic. It helps the digestion. It helps break down the gluten. It's a fermented food that's good for you. And it's made over many hours. And it's free from any preservatives or any additives of any
right.
kind.
Okay. Yeah.
So for me to say, oh, I'm gluten sensitive, I'm not talking about people with celiac disease.
No. I get you. I'm with you. Yep.
But I am saying that for some reason, you know, when somebody tastes a craft beer from a local brewery made from local grains, Budweiser isn't in the same sense.
That's right. Yep.
Right? They're not comparing Budweiser to the local craft beer, or they're not comparing Smirnoff to the local distillery. But yet when we talk about bread, we're talking about artisan bread and gluten in the same silo as all this other stuff. Yep. And I think it's really important to differentiate. I was talking to Maria Speck last week, who wrote the books on ancient grains.
Yes.
And she feels very strongly about the same thing. And you know, what's interesting in doing the research for the book, when you get it, you'll see, I spoke to a lot of agronomists and nutritionists. They're saying that even the DNA of many modern wheats is 99.9% the same as some heritage wheats.
Okay.
Not necessarily the ancient grains, but certainly heritage wheats. Okay.
Right.
So it doesn't make sense that all of a sudden modern human beings have developed this sensitivity to a food that is essentially the same, the original food, okay? And that, you know, basically the growth of mankind is the growth of the wheat industry. I mean, if you look it's 20% of global dietary protein comes in the form of wheat.
Right.
So I make a really strong case for this.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I'm glad. Like I've said for a while that, you know, we need another word for what it is we make, because the bread's been co-opted.
I think it's really important. I think we could call it a different kind of food.
Yeah.
You know, like artisan bread, slowly fermented bread is a different kind of food.
For sure.
We'll not talk about artisan bread and Wonder Bread in the same sense.
Yeah. So was that the driver for the new book, or what was the driver for the new book?
The new book, I would say the new book were several themes. One is, and I joke about it in the introduction to the book, I say that I'm a graduate of the backdoor school of baking.
The backdoor school.
Meaning I go to the backdoor bakeries, I invite myself in, I stay for a few nights, I stay for a week, I learn something. And in the process, not only am I learning about that bakery, I'm learning about their family, their local foods, and their local miller, and their local farmer, okay?
Yep.
And that my entire life as a baker has been basically a series, a long chain of introductions, meaning I met a baker a long time ago, and he introduced me to another baker who introduced me to his miller, and that miller introduced me to another baker, and that miller introduced me to his farmer, and that farmer told me about another baker. So my whole career has been one long chain of bread introduction.
That's right, yeah.
So the book, in part, is almost like a thank you to the many people that I've met.
Right.
That's one. Secondly, I think there's a lot of misinformation in the marketplace. Okay.
Yep.
So I have a chapter on milling.
Okay. Oh, nice.
And I talk about the difference in milling styles between Germany, France, and Italy.
Ah, okay.
And I talk specifically about how flours are sold and marketed.
Okay.
So, you know, in France, for example, they use this numeric system, type 150 as
bulk
meat, and Poiland probably uses a type 85, and most bakers that are making baguette a la tradition française are using type 65, and old baguettes were type 55, and croissants are 45.
Right.
And you can get a type 150 rye flour and a type 130, et cetera, et cetera. And in Italy, they have this numeric system. It's type 1, type 0, type 00, okay? And certainly in France, it makes testing flours, testing recipes really easy, because you know what? All the millers follow the same system.
Right, yeah.
And I write about this organization in France called BIPEA, B-I-P-E-A.
Right.
BIPEA is kind of the organization that works with all of the millers in France, helping to maintain milling standards and kind of raising the bar. Okay. So I talk about how BIPEA works. I talk about how millers work together. I actually have a BIPEA scorecard in the book. Okay. How they score bread.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And then I talk about in Italy that it's a completely different system and on the surface, very clear, but somewhat confusing when you dig in.
Sure.
So the example I use is, you know, everybody says Doppio Zero flour is the best flour for pizza.
Right.
Okay. But if you go to a typical mill in Italy and you say, I want Doppio Zero flour, they're going to say, what are you going to use it for? Because they sell like six different grades of Doppio Zero flour.
Oh.
So Doppio Zero flour is like saying type 55 in terms of refinement.
Right.
Okay. But they have Doppio Zero for thin pizzas, they have Doppio Zero flour for focaccia. They have Doppio Zero flour for more higher gluten breads.
Right.
So it's not like it means what we think it means.
Right. Yeah.
And in Germany, they have a system that's similar to France, except it's got an extra number. So whole wheat flour would be 105.
Okay.
But I find buying flour here in the States very confusing.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Sir Lancelot, Sir Galahad, Harvest King. I'm trying to think of some other brand names, okay?
Right, yeah.
But like, we get our flour, some of our flour from Milanese, La Milanese.
Okay.
And they have, I'm trying to think of some of their names are, they have these crazy names, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're starting to see some millers use French grading standards. I know Mark Nightingale and Mark Mills, he's doing a type 85 flour.
Okay.
Nikki Giusto is beginning to do like I think he's doing a type 65. So people are beginning to follow this system, which makes a lot of sense.
Right.
So I have a whole section on milling.
Nice.
I have a whole section on, I have a chapter on, and I did this on purpose. I went to Sicily.
Okay.
And I visited a group of organic farmers who work with the agronomist at the University of Palermo.
Okay.
Who is testing upwards of 300-400 varieties of wheat a year. Okay. They have what they call Grani Attico, which are a variety of heritage wheats. Of course, there's Amor Einkorns and different spelts. So, you know, they don't call it spelt in Italy. They call it farro, and there's different types of farro.
Right.
And I tell the story of how this agronomist tests his fields, how he gets it. Once he gets a certain seed stock, he gives it to a farmer. That farmer can isolate the crop and give it to a small miller, okay, because there's still small millers in Sicily.
Right.
And that small miller can isolate that crop, blend it or not blend it. And so now you have bakers in Sicily making bread from Majorca or Tuminia wheat. So you have bakers making, you know, single variety
of
bread. Yeah. Okay.
Nice.
Now, when I talk to the people at Milanese?
No, I don't. No.
Okay. So when I talked to them about it, they said, yeah, whenever we've tried that, like a single varietal of wheat, the bakers can't work with it because they're used to using blended wheats.
Right. I mean? Okay, sure.
So, I think we've got a ways to go here. And even in Vermont, where you've got some of these bakers, do you know the guy at Backdoor Bread?
Oh, sure. Jim, yeah.
Tim is using this wheat from... What's the name and the name of the wheat? It's like dynamite wheat. It's got a funny name. You know what I mean?
He's got Redeemer and
Redeemer. Okay. So Redeemer is a fairly high gluten. Wheat. Okay. Right. I don't know. I could call Jim and find out what the protein level is.
Sure.
But I can tell by his breads.
Yeah.
This is not 10.5% protein.
No.
And for him to use that Redeemer wheat, they grow it in Vermont. They have to ship it to New York to get cleaned.
Okay.
It gets harvested. It gets cleaned in New York State. It gets shipped back to Vermont. Okay.
All right.
And then he grinds it. He's grinding all of his own flour.
Yes.
Okay. But he said to me that when he gets the wheat back to the bakery, the wheat berries, not the flour.
Right.
It's like $1.20 a pound.
Right. Yeah. So
it's expensive.
I
can get containers of the best organic flour from France delivered to Bread Alone for 45 cents. I mean, 45 cents a pound.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So yeah, it's something that has to give to make it work well, over a larger scale. Yeah.
The $9 a loaf.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But I, so when did I write the book? I wanted to write about, different parts of, that's why I call it Living Bread.
Yeah.
I wanted to write about different parts of the baking industry in Europe, mm-hmm. because I still feel that the European baking infrastructure, for lack yes. of a better yes. term, is infinitely more versatile, more sophisticated, more knowledgeable, and I tell the story of this mill in Western France, and they have 5 full-time bakers working for the mill, working with their clients all the time, trying to improve the quality of the bread.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
You know, this is a mid-sized mill.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. I mean, we're all out on our own. I mean, like, you know, like maybe if you deal with General Mills, they'll send a test baker for a day or something.
Right.
But like there's a culture of sophistication. I talk through all of the tests that are done on wheat in France, yeah. you know, just before it even gets ground. I talk about the tests that are done on how they test the baking the bread, because I think there's a lot for us to learn here.
Yeah. Well, and that's really been, to me, that's been the spirit of all your books that I've read. There, that's always the sense that I get, is that it's a bit of a celebration of the way things are done there, what's happening even in local breads, right? Where, you know, it was specific bakers that you were hanging out with and then sharing stories and then sharing recipes and that. But it was like, I always read your books in the spirit of there's a lot to learn over there, and we can exactly. benefit from bringing that back here.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. Yeah. And I would say one of the single biggest challenges that we have here is just the lack of mills.
Sure. Sure. Especially for just the size of the country and the number of people, and that it's wildly different, you know, like it's starting, but it's not, not there.
And, you know, have you been to Maine Grains?
No, I've talked with Amber and I've talked with Kristen
I went there the other day because I wanted.
Oh, nice.
Okay. So everything is moving in the right direction.
Right. Yeah.
But it's on such a more fundamental layer of sophistication than even the simple mills I've seen in France. Like Amber, if she went to this little mill that I went to in Sicily that I write about in the book, like they have tempering rooms for the wheat. I mean, like even before they mill anything,
yeah.
the grain is tempered, and they have these old fashioned cement holding bins where they have controls where they temper the wheat before it's stone ground. And they've got these old fashioned flour sifters with wooden frames, and you know, they have 2 mills that are probably doing 250 kilos an hour. You know, so there's real throughput. They've got a semi-automatic bagging machine. I mean, Amber, I was literally watching. The person has to put the bag on the scale, and then the flour comes out in a very slow. And then the person can do other things, but the person's got to keep an eye on when the flour comes up to the bag, and then they've got to bang the bag and do the zipper. I mean, all of that bagging is all done automatically.
Right.
Automatic palletization. I mean, Amber says she does a pallet a day.
Yeah.
And, okay. I mean, the mills that I was visiting do, you know, I'm trying to think how long would it take them. They're probably doing like Sweer, the one mill I talk about. It's it's a robotic bagging system. I would say every 30 seconds. It's probably 30 seconds to fill a 25 kilo bag.
Right.
Then it's closed automatically. So that's how many is, let's call it 2 bags a minute, 50 bags in a pallet. So in 20 minutes, they have a pallet.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Amber's working for a day. So is it moving in the right direction? Yeah. As long as she can sell her flour for $1.20 a pound.
Oh, and that's the thing. And then that's what
I'm making observations. Oh, I'm not making judgments.
Not at all. I always see what you write about as sort of the, it's in a way describing the future over here by describing what's current state over there. It's hopefully describing
the future here. The title of the book is Tradition and Innovations.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's the thing. That's what's going to get the price of bread down where everyone can still make a living, right? Is by that innovation.
Well, listen, if all of a sudden, you know, I don't know what will create the balance. You know, I mean, you've got farmers now willing to grow these local grains because if it's not good for bread, they can sell it to malters, they can sell it to distributors. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure. And I was talking with another woman in California about that, where, you know, it's one thing to say, yeah, I'd like to buy all this flour, but she's got to find, she's needing to find other outlets for the grain in bad years that she can't use it for bread.
And you know, like someone like Nicky Giusto, he buys very little.
Right.
I mean, Nicky's probably would you say he's the leading artisan bake miller in the United States?
Yeah, from what I know. Yeah, for sure. Because he's got the kitchen alongside now and stuff.
Yeah. I'm supposed to teach a class there next week.
Oh, good. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Well, with the fires, who knows what's going to
happen. Yeah.
You know,
that's true.
Because he's right there. Petaluma is right.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I can't imagine they're going to go ahead with the class. It's on November 5th. And, you know, like it's an apocalypse.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
But anyway, I had long talks with Nikki, both about the local grain movement and about bakers milling their own flour.
Right.
And, one thing we haven't talked about, and something that I don't have the answer to right now.
Okay.
So there's this new book called The Bread Lab, where the guy talks a lot about milling your own flour.
Okay.
Yeah. And he is making the case that freshly ground flour is infinitely healthier.
Okay.
Than aged flour.
Okay.
Okay. They're making two cases. They're saying it tastes much better.
Right.
And they're saying that it's healthier.
Okay.
Okay. Now, tasting better, that's empirical. I guess we could have blind bread tastings.
Yeah.
Like we have wine tastings, and people who know could say, yes, it is, or no, it isn't.
Sure. Yeah.
But I find this question of, is freshly ground flour healthier for you? I think it's a question that I would like to have answered.
Yeah.
And I'm not the person who can do it. It has to be, you know, this has to be done in labs with nutritionists.
Right,
like, I don't know how you do that. It's kind of like they did those tests years ago, were organic carrots healthier than commercial carrots?
Right.
You know, and there was mixed results, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but that's something that I would like to, it's something that people are beginning to really talk about. And I think it's something that would be great to have an answer to.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Because that's certainly a trend, or at least an anecdotal trend that I'm seeing with people that I talk to, is that, you know, they're budgeting for mills right when they're opening their bakery, kind of a thing. We talked right at the start about that, where I've talked with other, you know, very like well-seasoned bakers that have said, like, I don't know that I want to learn another craft. You know, I'm trying to master this craft of baking, you know, trying to be a master miller at the same time is a tough one.
And if you look at old mills, they were basically stone mills. And I mean, I've been to lots of old mills, but, you know, dressing the stones, managing them properly, making sure that you don't get pieces of metal, or, you know what I mean? Like,
yep.
Are these people putting, you know, metal detectors on their mill? I mean, you know, a big mill has a metal detector.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen videos of those that, can take them. Yeah. You know, and like, and I've talked with Andrew at Elmer Mountain Bread and New American Stone Mills and you know, I love what he's doing, and the folks that buy his mills, seem really happy, but I understand the sort of the choices anyways. And I like what you're saying. Listen, about,
if you look at Jim, for example,
yeah,
Jim is milling all his own flour.
Right.
Okay. Some of the bakers I've read about are milling all their own flour.
Right.
But I read more bakers who are blending like 10% or 50%. You know, like their whole wheat flours are stone ground and their white flours are not.
Yep.
I mean, it feels like it's a marketing tool.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
You know, rather than, you know, a commitment to stone milling your own flour.
Right. Yeah, yeah. I gotcha, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, are we open to the idea of having a mill of bread alone? Yeah. Are we rushing to it? No. Do we make really good bread that I'm really proud of? Absolutely. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, could it be better? Yeah. There is no perfect loaf. It's always getting better.
Right. But again, what I love about what you've done is, again, you've been able to build a business that has grown over, you know, 30 plus years, and, you know, and where you can run, you know, three cafes as well. And you've got wholesale like crazy and stuff, and still keep a very high standard of products that you're making. That's amazing to me. Amazing. It's awesome as far as I'm concerned, because that's a whole other challenge and a whole other bit of work. And I love it. You know? Yeah.
And you know, I should add that my son is running the business now day to day.
Okay. Yeah.
My oldest son is, and he is, he's extremely environmentally conscious.
Right.
We just put last year we put a 660 panel solar system on the roof of the bakery.
Nice.
And he wants to get to producing all of our own power.
Wow. Right on.
With a couple of years. So we're looking at a 2000 plus a solar array panel. You know, we're looking at every aspect of the business. How do we make it greener?
Yeah.
So we're doing more than just baking organic bread at this point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean,
for sure.
We're a mission driven business.
Yeah. Love it. Well, and you know, and that's what the Maggie Gelzer's book, that Artisan Baking Across America. Yeah. That's there. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I always dream one day I'm going to write the sequel to that and bring it up to date. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the point of that book that really grabbed me is, look, there are big artisan bakeries and there are small artisan bakeries. And it's like, you can make good bread at other scale.
Let's use that book as an example.
Yeah.
How many of those bakeries exist in the form? Tomcat's been sold. Tomcat's owned by Yamakaze Bakery now.
Okay. Yeah.
Sold for $70 million last year. Okay. Acme is still basically the same, but Steve is asking real questions about succession. I'm very close with Steve.
Oh, okay.
I have a son.
Yes.
But Steve's partners are all retiring.
Ah. Oh.
You know?
Yeah.
Was La Brea in that book? Who was in that book?
I don't think La Brea was in there.
Yeah. But La Brea is now the mega factory.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You know,
Craig was in there, and then, but his whole thing's changed now.
Craig Kovanek?
Craig Ponsford.
Oh yeah, Craig Ponsford. He took in some partners,
yep,
and destroyed. You know what, yep, I mean?
Yep.
Basically, kicked out of his business.
Yeah, yeah, and so that's actually a really good point about sort of the where are they now, or like what's happened to each of the bakeries in that story.
Yeah. And yeah. Noel, I'm good friends with Noel. Noel's retired. He sold the bakery 10 years ago, and Tomcat, and, you know, James is out. I mean, and you know, so, you know, but that's also life, you know?
Yes. Yeah. For sure. For sure. Well, wow. Well, this has been so much fun. You have no idea how.
I look forward to you getting the book, and when if you have more questions, let me know.
I will, for sure. But you know, I just want to say, like, right from the first day I launched the show, you're one of the people I've always wanted to talk to. And really, and so you've been on my list, and it's sort of like, okay, you know, I got to get up the nerve to ask you.
How long have you been doing this?
Well, I have 76 episodes right now. So I've been, March 2018 is when I started. So coming on a year and a half, or just over a year and a half. So I've been doing, trying to do one a week.
How many people listen to each episode?
Well, right off the hop, I get about 400 people right on the day of, and then over the course of the week, I think I get another four. So it's got to be, I think I'm up around 60,000 downloads for for 70 episodes, that kind of a thing. The last I checked. But always more than I thought. Like, I guess that's, you know, because it's an ever expanding world for me. It's like when you write your books and you talk about.
And it was interesting. Now, when you post it, I'll put it on my Instagram.
Oh yes, of course.
I'm sure you'll pick up a bunch of people.
Yeah, I'll send links and stuff as well. Yeah, it's when I talk to authors, there's always a bit of a spike for sure. Okay.
But listen, I want to hear from you after you get the book.
I will absolutely. I'll reach out again.
Great talking to you.
Thank you. Bye bye. Cool, eh? My goodness. That was Daniel Leader. His new book is called Living Bread. I forgot to mention it at the start of the show today, but it looks, or it sounds like an amazing book. I'm trying to find a copy here in Victoria, or maybe I think they're going to send me one, but we'll see. But I really want to read this one. I'm as excited about it as I have been of any of his books. And can't wait to read it. And so if you have a copy, drop me a line. Let me know. I'd love to hear what you think of it as well. A different kind of a talk, I guess, compared to the last few episodes that we've done, because, you know, we talk with bakers big and small here. And the last few episodes have skewed maybe a little more towards the smaller bakery. And, you know, Daniel, they've been doing it 37 years. Like, awesome. Like, holy nina, that's so great. But it's different. You know, it's a different kind of thing than with a lot of the folks that I'm talking to. And I think he raises a lot of really good points here about, you know, this sort of 10 years and then you burn out and you go do something else. And I've experienced that, you know, I've experienced the stress and the workload and not sure what I'm going to do next. So, you know, I've talked with a lot of folks that are going through exactly the same thing that Daniel described. And that's, you know, in so many ways, that's why I started that Bakers for Bakers community, because I really want to figure out a way with the other bakers to get us all over this 10-year hump so that we can all sustain over the long term. And I think he put it really well. It's so funny, not knowing anything about what I'm doing. But, you know, he just kind of starts going with this sort of idea of 10 years and then, you know, it becomes too hard to maintain, you know, a small operation for, you know, beyond 10 years. And I don't know that it's impossible, but I do know it takes an awful lot of focused work, you know, to get over that hump. And maybe you don't have to be as big as Bread Alone to make it work. But it takes an awful lot of effort to make it work. And that's the real thing that I'm most curious about and most excited about trying to figure out with other bakers is how can we get over this this 5-year hump or this 10-year hump and create businesses that work for us as well as for the people that we serve. So it was a great talk with Daniel. I was so inspired to meet him. And I think he speaks a lot of truth, a lot of painful truth for us smaller folks, but you know, better off hearing it when we can do something about it than hearing it after the fact. Right. So, I hope you enjoyed the chat. I'd love to hear what you think, about this talk or any episode or, baking in general. Drop me a line, mark@riseuppod.com. Or check me out on Instagram, where I'm Mad Baker. You can reach out to me there. It's just an absolute pleasure bringing these episodes to you. I hope you enjoyed this one. We're going to have another one next week. Let's keep it going. Until then, have a great week. Make the good stuff and happy baking. Bye-bye.